board.
Like he said, this is a draft that we've worked on and edited a time or two. Rather than read the whole thing to you, I'm just going to try to highlight some things that I think will be worthy of your attention. And there's a couple points where I'm going to specifically point out that there's either a difference of opinion or a variety of opinions that might exist, or places where I would ask for your advice or discussion either now or some point in the future for that. As Bill mentioned, this was the committee, and these are the folks that did the work on this in the last, the last 100 days. Ronnie has changed jobs, and so Ronnie has been replaced by Steve Kappas from ARS, and so we're grateful for Steve joining the team as well. The focus of these guidelines are only on DNA tests for quantitative traits used in selection. Okay, there are many other applications of DNA tests in the industry, management, parentage identification, tracing tissues to the industry. That has not been addressed in what I'm going to share with you now. Only DNA tests intended for use in selecting potential parents. Tuesday night, I showed you this table. I used this slide in several talks, but we can have, if we think about traits and where we get information from them, some of them might not have any information, but we have at least three other combinations. We can have pedigrees and phenotypes, or pedigrees and phenotypes in DNA, or just DNA by itself. And so the bottom row is probably of most interest today. But this is in view as we make these guidelines. We spent a fair amount of time trying to come up with a philosophy, and I shared this also Tuesday night. You can read this. I won't read it to you. The more I've ground on this myself, I'm convinced that the best service we can provide the industry is to keep things simple if it's possible. And that adding terminology has never been easy in the beef industry. I mean, how many years has it taken to get commercial folks, people that buy bulls, to understand what an EPD is? So if we start changing the terminology, we have just that adds to the challenges. And so tried to keep or avoid adding terms to what we're going. So in our view, where we're headed for is regardless of where the information comes from, that we still call the selection tool that we make the decision from an EPD, whether it comes from DNA information alone or DNA information in phenotypes or just phenotypes. An EPD is an EPD, and it can be calculated from various combinations of information, but let's call it the same thing. I don't think we help the producers much by calling it a marker-assisted EPD or something else, even though I've used that terminology myself. I think if you kind of had your radar up for that in the last 2 days, you've heard a variety of different terms used for information coming from DNA. So I'm not sure that's helpful to the average producer. So within a trait, for the same trait, we'd like to see EPDs with the same units, the same measure of accuracy, just like BIF recommends for traits that they handle today. Validation. Validation is, as Dick has described, is something many of you are familiar with. To me, validation serves to reduce risk for the people that buy the tests. And it implies some sort of third-party involvement in determining whether the tests work. I'm going to give you a couple statements here that are really more they're references to more traditional validation, as Dick has described, and then offer a comment about that. BIF recommends that breeders who use DNA tests should, whenever possible, choose DNA tests that have been validated in animal populations that are representative of the beef cattle industry and by scientists independent of the party that developed or will market the test. Okay, so that's kind of what we've done before. In addition, BIF recommends that the industry accept published peer-reviewed scientific studies as evidence of acceptable validation of DNA tests. Now, some of you may disagree with that, but I'll throw that out. Now, the comment I'd like to make is the model that Steve has presented and that I've tried to outline for the evaluation of a DNA test as a selection tool and putting that into in a national cattle evaluation involves more than traditional validation. It involves this estimation of covariances between the test score and the trait. It involves estimation of covariances among competing tests as well as the genetic relationships between the test and non-target traits, which is a different thing. And those procedures are carried out allow the computation of accuracy and an EPD. So one thing for you to consider is, you know, if you agree that's the direction we should go, then maybe we don't need to make these last two comments about validation. If we're going to redefine validation to be something else, maybe we don't need to say this sort of thing. I have hard copies of this, a few that I brought with me. If you want one of those, I think Bill would provide it to you. If not, I can email one to you. They're labeled as drafts, and we would welcome your comments on them. And these points of question are identified in there. They're identified clearly in the draft. Assessment is this idea of estimating the relationship among competing tests as well as the relationship of the DNA test to non-target traits. We would propose that BIF recommends that assessment studies should be conducted in reference populations representative of the beef cattle industry by independent third parties as well. So reference populations is, I'm kind of a broken record on that. It seems to me that that's such a very critical piece of what we're proposing for where we are today to get to a point where we can use the DNA information and where appropriate combine it with phenotypic information. We need to have populations which we can genotype and that have been extensively phenotyped to estimate these relationships. So BIF recognizes the extreme importance of pedigreed reference populations for the successful implementation of DNA-based selection tools in the beef industry. BIF considers the partnership of USDA ARS and Agriculture Canada in the establishment and maintenance of reference populations to be critical to the successful implementation of DNA-based selection tools in the beef industry. I think I'm not Canadian, so I can't speak for Canada, but in the United States, the public has made a tremendous investment in this technology over the last 20 years. And so I think those of us that work in the public sector, we need to try to help get the technology available to the average producer, whoever he or she might be. And so I think it's really important that the federal government be involved here. The states largely have de-emphasized the maintenance of experimental beef cattle populations. There's very few states that have herds of meaningful size or that can be used in research for this sort of thing. And so the burden falls to the federal government. Certainly there's a role for private herds to provide data that could be used like a reference population, But it's harder for me to imagine that private producers will be able to justify the expense to collect some of these difficult phenotypes that may be of interest. Further, federally funded reference populations could justify, it seems to me, the collection of data on animals that may never be practical in the industry to develop DNA tests for what I'll call novel traits later, traits that we'll never expect to have industry phenotypes. So I guess this is my way of trying to emphasize how important, at least I think, the Clay Center are and Agriculture Canada are in helping this technology be applied. You've seen this diagram before. I don't think I have anything to add that I didn't say just a few minutes ago. To review, the evaluation of DNA tests as a selection tool involves the estimation of the covariances between the DNA test and the target trait, the covariances among the competing tests, the covariances between the DNA test and non-target traits, and it ends up allowing the computation of an EPD with a corresponding accuracy. Okay? Then we would say this. If the DNA test is intended for use in multiple breed types and production marketing systems, then the reference populations and production systems used should permit the evaluation of the interactions among breed types and production environments. Another way of maybe it should, we should also say, like the example that Dick just presented, that if a DNA test is for a specific breed type or a specific production environment, that's where it should be evaluated, much like the example that he showed. Now, this may be a little futuristic from where we are today in some cases. You know, we may have to walk before we can run. But if we're going to, this is, I think, the ideal. Well, if a DNA test has been evaluated in the reference population, and these statistics have been included, then what are the considerations for including it in a national cattle evaluation program, especially one in which there are phenotypes collected in the industry? That's where it's really relevant. Some things to consider are the heritability of the trait and the availability of producer-collected phenotypes, because those two things give us some idea of how much added information is going to be provided by the DNA test. Denny Cruz's talk this morning highlighted that. Steve's talk also highlighted that. So the point is really the increased accuracy from the DNA test. And I think at least the committee's opinion was that decision should be made by who's ever computing the EPDs and communicating that to the breed or the industry. That's their decision, that we can't magically come up with a single number for all traits because it varies by trait. So BIF recommends that a DNA test should be considered for inclusion in the NCE system when, after estimating the covariances and running the NCE system, use of the DNA test results in a more accurate EPD at a young age. I think one of the nice things about using it this way and using these reference populations, if they are genetically linked to the breed, U.S. and Canadian populations well, then once a test has been evaluated, you've already seeded the EPDs for the breed, because you've calculated EPDs for animals that are tightly linked in the breed. Probably several of the popular sires are represented in those populations. So you've got a head start on really getting this thing available to the breed. Databases. DNA tests change frequently. We've heard examples of that just in the last few minutes. That's, I think, to be expected, that the technology that backs up the tests, the number of markers, et cetera, that's going to change and may change often for a while. And the database needs to to be able to handle that. We're not, you know, every time a test changes, then that should somehow be logged in that database so we know that which animal was tested with which test. Even if it was the same company, which generation of the test was used in there. The database should be able to accommodate multiple companies and access to the raw data, in other words, access to the genotypes that come back or the raw scores, however the company reports them. That may be a sensitive issue. Producers may not want other producers to see that. They may not, you know, and I think that's a consideration for how the database is constructed and managed. And so we would recommend that breed associations should establish procedures that encourage the full reporting of all DNA tests, and that may only happen if the access to the raw data is restricted. Interim EPD. I would remind you that once a DNA test has been evaluated, like in the model that we've shown and that Steve has described, that even at that point, that will produce an EPD that could be estimated from the DNA test with an associated accuracy in the absence of any other information. So if they've been evaluated in this way, then as soon as the DNA test, as soon as the genotypes are run, you plug it into whatever formula that is, and you'll have an estimate of the EPD and an accuracy for the standalone DNA. But if there are phenotypes collected in the industry that could make it even more accurate, we would recommend that the interim EPD be communicated to breeders as soon as possible after the DNA tests are completed. And the thinking here is that if we're going to really be of use in helping the technology to be adopted, then the information needs to be available to the producers quickly so they can use it to make a decision. That will be important. Whole genome scans. There's lots of issues, I think, with whole genome scans that may need to be considered. One is the value of the genotypes. That the genotypes from animals that have been tissues have been gone through these large SNP chip evaluations, those might be useful for a long time from a scientific point of view in developing or improving new tests, things like breed-specific effects, new traits, non-additive effects. Those things may not be estimable now, but as data accumulates, they might be estimable later. It's possible that each polymorphism could be uniquely identified without disclosing the location, I suppose. So this is sort of a controversial recommendation that we would need some discussion on. The BIF recommends that the genotype of each individual polymorphism in the test should be reported and stored in breed or national databases. This is one that I'll have to confess that I'm uncomfortable with. Not everybody is. That's why it's here. But it makes me wonder whether to put this in a guideline if we're not infringing on the company's property rights or trade secrets. And so that's my doubt about it. I can see the value in having this data available, but if the company... I just worry about infringing on their business by doing that. Any comment from any of the company people? Okay, reporting of DNA tests by genomic companies. I've battled with this in my own mind over the last year, not knowing exactly what I should think about this. I think a couple of the issues are, one is companies use various techniques to brand their products to make them recognizable by their customers, and that's part of doing business. But we also I think one of the roles of BIF is this idea of standardization of techniques and procedures. So we have some competing goals there, maybe. So to be consistent with the guiding philosophy that I put up early in the talk, this is our recommendation at this point, that BIF recommends that DNA test results be reported in the form of an EPD and the units of the trait on a continuous scale and with a corresponding BIF accuracy. Again, we're trying to be consistent with the idea that an EPD is an EPD and it should have an accuracy. That this makes it most useful to the producer, whether it's been combined, whether you combine it with phenotypic information or not, to make it more accurate, it's still an EPD that has a consistent interpretation. Now, the methods that Steve outlined yesterday will accept DNA test results reported by a company that are not in this form. They could be, as long as they're reported as a continuous variable, I think his methods will pretty well harvest the information on breeding value out of them. So even management markers that have additive and non-additive genetic effects in them could be plugged into Steve's method, and an EPD could still come out. And so, again, that's something I'd like you to consider relevant to this type of a recommendation. I still like the idea of trying to keep things simple and standardized, but the methods that Steve outlined do not actually require that. A hand, Mark? Could you all hear what Mark had to say?
So I guess I would like to see a recommendation be tests that are for collection purposes included.
So I would suggest that tests that are intended for marker assisted selection purposes would be expressed on a scale that reports the additive component only, and that tests that are intended for an application such as marker-assisted management would be reported on a scale that includes the non-additive as well as the additive genetic variation. That doesn't mean the companies have to do it that way, but I think we should be on record as recommending that that's the way that's most effective for the beef industry.
Any other comments or questions? Hand in the back. Yes, Don?
I just have a quick question regarding the reporting of accuracies associated with the EPDs from just the marker effect alone, because if you have an animal that you just genotype and you add in together maybe a number of independent effects to get an estimated molecular breeding value, you're not immediately going to get a prediction error associated with that. And so how are you going to derive that accuracy associated with that? And would that accuracy be different from a typical BIF accuracy?
Well, again, it's going back to this idea of the model that I presented about how we evaluate a DNA test in the reference population. And if it's done that way, that allows an accuracy to be associated with that DNA test, whether it's got phenotypes added to it or not.
So are you proposing that the results that will be reported by the company
be the estimates that come from the validation in the reference population instead of the company's own estimates?
Where I think you'll see there's an exception of that coming, but yes, if the reference population collects the phenotypes that are appropriate to the DNA test, the answer would be yes.
So you're saying that for a particular DNA test for a particular trait, the accuracy reported with that is the same for every molecular breeding value for that trait?
Yeah.
So it's not a computation. It's been done a priori. It's appended to that.
If it's just the DNA test standalone, yes, it would be the same for every animal. Question here, Dick.
What are you talking about reporting? Anybody, everybody, specific sectors?
I think that would be, in my mind, it's reporting it back to the breeder, whoever ordered the test, paid for the test. If the information goes on into a national cattle evaluation system, or is there industry collected phenotypes, that's what goes forward into that database. Was there another? Gerard, did you have your hand up?
He was okay for now, I think.
You're okay?
So, Mike, let me ask that question. I think Dick expand that a little bit. So, it's one thing if those data go into a breed association genetic evaluation, but what if it were seed stock producers that weren't aligned with a national cattle evaluation? So how does that accuracy get adapted or adjusted or evaluated? It's the same every time for every animal, regardless?
If it's just the DNA test alone, there's no other information trying to supplement that, then for a given marker, then a given marker panel, a given test, that the accuracy would be the same. Essentially, it's based upon what proportion of the additive genetic variance is accounted for by the test.
This is the question I had before that I asked, and if you go back to the simple test where you have three alleles, and say you're testing for tenderness, and maybe you have one bull that has one allele, one of the good alleles of each for each marker. And then you have another one that only has it's homozygous for the one marker that has the biggest effect. So maybe their EPD, their genetic EPD would be almost the same, but in the case of the animal that's just has one allele from one of the good markers for each location, there's only a 50% chance or a 50% probability that he'll transmit that. In the case of the one that's homozygous for the one good one, he'll transmit one every time. So how do you account for that?
Well, I guess I really don't have anything profound to add to what Steve and Dick have already told you, is that if it's several genes in the panel and you had an animal that had many homozygous loci for the desirable effects, that estimated EPD is going to be better, much better than an animal that's all heterozygous or has several homozygous loci for the less desirable allele. If you this technique that Steve has described is assuming that we'll be using information from panels of markers rather than one or two markers. Right.
Okay. I think I'm understanding a little bit better in terms of what you're asking. In terms of when we're taking a look at the accuracy, it's reflecting the accuracy towards the composite EPD. And so if you have a single marker, even though you'll have a really good idea in terms of what's being transmitted for that particular marker, you'll have a relatively poor idea in terms of what the composite EPD is for that animal, and so there'd be a lot of noise left over. So where it would fall apart is if you had a single marker, which accounted for just about all the genetic variation, and then what you're talking about becomes very important. But I don't think we're really running into that at this point. No, we're about, I mean, with the panels we have, go ahead. Oh, well, first of all, there's three, and there's not one. And even with the three, we're only accounting for a small proportion of the total genetic variance in there. Yeah. So there's some approximation involved, but in the big scheme of things, it's a relatively small approximation.
Okay.
Sally, are you getting at that there's more progeny variation in the bull that's heterozygous than in the bull that's homozygous? And so I think we would agree that there's going to be more variation among progeny, but that's not what accuracy measures. The breeding value is the expected value of what comes from the progeny, and that expected value is going to be the same in either case. And so the accuracy is not really different in that case. That's my understanding of the answer to your question.
Okay. Now, for some tests, well, it's likely that research will develop some new DNA tests for traits that do not have industry-collected phenotypes. But it may be that those phenotypes have been or can be collected in the reference populations. Okay? So, especially if you think of the reference population being largely composed of animals at some place like Clay Center or one of the other federal stations where there are funds available to collect phenotypes that are not practical or they're too expensive for a regular producer to collect. If that is the case, if the target trait is measured in the reference population, we would recommend that the evaluation of the DNA test be done as I've outlined above. So even though you may not ever augment that with industry-collected phenotypes, if you could run it through the system that Steve has outlined, you would determine the accuracy associated with that test, and that could be used with that test as long as you don't change the technology behind the test. Now, another set of traits that I've, all, for the lack of something better to call them, I've called them novel traits. These would be traits for which the target traits for some new DNA test may not be measured in the reference populations. A company may develop a test, or a test may be developed that nobody has a reference population that NBCEC or whoever is in charge of the evaluation can have access to. At that point, it seems to me that the way we would do at least some type of independent validation would be to review or reanalyze the data used to develop the test. You know, you don't have anything that's truly independent there, and that the data used hopefully will have not only the DNA test results but the phenotypes, pedigrees if possible, and that the data itself hopefully will be of sufficient quality to estimate these variances and covariances that are needed to compute an accuracy. So, in that light, BIF recommends that for target traits that have no industry-collected phenotypes and for which no phenotypes are collected in reference populations, the results from such novel DNA tests should be reported in the form of an EPD in units of the trait on a continuous scale and with a corresponding BIF accuracy. And that's sort of the end of the draft that I brought with me. So I'll try to answer a question. Don? Yes, I brought some copies with me that Bill has in his hand.
I guess
if you don't get one and want one, I'd be glad to email it to you. We're not ashamed for this to be distributed. Just don't take the word draft off of it, so it doesn't appear to somebody that it's been adopted by BIF, because it has not been.
Again, we've got kind of limited copies here that we'll try to get at least to all of the companies and research institutions if they can share. But again, as Mike indicated, contact him or myself and we can email you a copy, and we'll try to make that available, and would appreciate feedback going back to Mike and trying to get your thoughts on the process. Mark?
Real nice job.
Recommendations. The point that I guess I'd like some clarification on is the recommendation that we accept peer-reviewed scientific papers as validation.
Okay.
And as you know, I have some issues with that. And so does that mean one peer-reviewed paper and they're in? Or I mean, is it that simple? Or Is there some other criteria for evaluating that? What's your thought on that one?
I guess so. I mean, what if Gary develops a test from the 50K chip, puts it in the Journal of Animal Science, and it's accepted, and one of the companies picks up that and chooses to use that test? Do they need to go attempt an independent validation, and who do they go to?
Yeah, and, you know, if Gary writes the paper, it's good enough for me. But but you know, I've seen a lot of other papers that I have absolutely no confidence in, and you know,
I don't know what to say.
The only documentation worse than some of those papers would be that the patent office awarded a patent for it, which would be even less credible. But, I've seen too much stuff that's just junk that gets published. And I'm not comfortable with one period of paper and it's in. No, that's just my opinion.
Okay. Well, we can certainly, that's why I brought that up. If that's an inappropriate recommendation from BIF, we need to know that and not include that in the guidelines. Is that a hand or a scratch?
I think we really run a huge risk if we start looking at the value of individual papers, because it could be that there's a test out there you guys get really excited about using in a management system, and you use thousands of animals and you run those tests in the Meat Animal Research Center thing, and it comes out as a publication. I'd be a little concerned that we negate that as a validation because we're afraid somebody down the road is going to use 400 animals, forgot to fit sires or something like that. And I don't want us to say you need more than one, but I also don't want us to get into the point where we're choosing between scientists and published papers.
Or between journals.
This is a dangerous area for us to be skating on in terms of validation.
Yeah, you may need to sit by.
John, as usual, we're saying the same thing and arguing about it. I was not proposing that Gary's paper should count as validation. My point was exactly the same thing that you were saying. I don't think that we want to get in the business of choosing. I think we have to have a clear standard, and because of that, I'm uncomfortable with the whole guideline about accepting peer-reviewed papers as a validation.
Is it possible to write that so that it says what's required, so that possibly a peer-reviewed paper would satisfy, but without even mentioning peer-reviewed papers? It isn't the peer review that you're concerned about. It's whether the study was appropriate. Or do you want it all to be after the fact, independent data, et cetera?
Brett?
I'm curious, Mark, are you going to make an exception if Gary publishes the paper versus if I do? Yeah, no, that's good. Let me ask another question. Just for clarification, Mike, what's the timeline on the guidelines?
That's a good question, Brent. As I understand it, we're at the genetic prediction workshop in December, which is December 8 through 10. Is that correct? That Dr. Cundiff wants to use part of that time to discuss guidelines. I doubt if he wants to finalize everything by that time, but it would sure be good if we had another draft ready by that time. So your comments were, I would ask for them and solicit them to the committee or to me or to Bill, however you feel comfortable giving them. I think one of the things is we've probably left out something here. You know, we've probably not considered an aspect of something, and we need your help in identifying that, as well as errors that we've made or things that we should delete out of here.
If I could just ask for one more clarification. If I understand right, then the process would add actually another step to what we're doing today if we go through the validation, because today we would have an internal validation, then we'd have an external validation, potentially, not always, with the NBCEC. And I think what you're saying in your guidelines is before you would really like a company to report results back to any commercial customer, you would want them to actually genotype one or more reference populations to actually be able to calculate that EPD and accuracy that would then be used.
If I understand your question right, I think we would replace the kind of validation you're doing with Dick with the reference population.
Okay, good. Thanks.
Yes, sir.
From a producer point of view, I've seen an awful lot of sale catalogs that publish the EPDs and there's no accuracies put on there. Like a lot of them just don't give a consideration. That's partly education, but it goes back to one of your recommendations. You say an EPD is an EPD. It doesn't matter where it comes from. And I guess I would like, as you know, going out to buy a bull, if it was only calculated on molecular values, which at this time are probably pretty low accuracy, that I knew that. So for your recommendation, I don't know how you could change that or alter it, but it concerns me a little bit that there's going to be EPDs that are going to be published out in bull sale catalogs that won't have a published accuracy, and I won't know how they're generated.
Well, I would agree that part of it's education, that it's maybe unfortunate that producers don't know that many of the EPDs and sale catalogs have very low accuracy even now. But I guess part of the motivation is that rather than someone this morning, I can't remember who it was, talked about the difference between push through and pull through technology, that if we have, if we can provide breeders and producers that use these tools with EPDs, with accuracies, whether they're interim EPDs or not, on a timely basis, that they can use them for decisions, use them in marketing, that if I'm selling bulls yearling bulls today, and Steve's got comparable yearling bulls across the street to sell tomorrow. His have DNA information on them, and his accuracies are 10, 15 percentage points better than mine, then that probably has some economic value.
Mike.
Just to reply to his statement from a breed association standpoint, as you say, it is sometimes difficult to get people to print the accuracies associated with those EPDs. How are we going to get them to kind of understand how to properly use a whole different system? Just a point.
Right.
Mike, if I remember correctly, correct me if I'm not remembering right, You didn't really ever state a threshold anywhere in here, did you? So when you talked about using Steve's approach to say that you're going to include, you know, the molecular data in genetic evaluation, you made a generic statement,
right,
but you never said anything about a
we
threshold.
We did not, no. We felt like that would vary from trait to trait based upon how heritable the trait was. If a trait is highly heritable, the phenotype of the trait may give you more information than the DNA test today. If it's a trait where phenotypes are difficult to collect, then even though the DNA test may explain only a small portion of the DNA variant, the genetic variance is still better than what you've got. So that's a breed association decision.
Yeah, because that's a point of discussion around the world that's being highly variable in the way it's being approached. And I just point that out behind.
So we did not specify a threshold, and I guess if the consensus is we should, I don't know what the threshold should be, but we didn't. We didn't establish one yet.
Okay, if there's no other questions, we probably need to kind of keep moving. I guess I want to personally thank Mike and his committee. I mean, they have done a tremendous job. Mike has kept everyone on task and got a lot accomplished. Let's give Mike a round of applause for his work. Again, I think as we see this technology being developed, see it being used in the industry more and more every day, I think to provide Mike with some feedback on these guidelines, and I think we know that Dr. Cundiff's official revision of the guidelines, it may be in a year and a half down the road, but I think relative to BIF and having guidelines for this technology, if we can finalize a draft that the board can approve prior to that, with that going on to the website, Mark, I think that's very desirable as well. So, again, Mike, we appreciate your help on that. Okay, we'll kind of shift gears now to the next presentation, and this project I've asked Mark to kind of visit with us some today, again, started really with the group at the Meat Animal Research Center back in, I guess, August of last year, provided an invitation to the breed associations, had representatives from several breed associations get an opportunity to go to Clay Center and talk about whole genome scanning and some of the utility of that technology and implement a really exciting project, I think, for the industry as we look forward. And so I've asked Mark to kind of represent the research crew there at Clay Center and give us an update on that project today.